This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You may think Vermont's cold, and after the last couple of days, I would not disabuse you of that notion. But we do not have an ice sheet covering our land that's more than a mile thick, at least not anymore. Greenland's ice sheet is nearly 2 miles thick in some places, and it covers nearly the whole island. But the ice sheet is melting faster than it's able to replenish itself, and scientists studying Greenland are concerned about what the melting of the ice sheet might mean for global sea level. One thing they're trying to figure out is what has happened in the past. Has the ice sheet been through multiple freeze-thaw cycles, or has it stayed fairly stable for the past several million years? The answers to those questions might help us understand what's likely to happen in the future. That's why it was interesting when two studies done by different teams of researchers were recently published in Nature that seemed to give us different information. Both used samples of the bedrock under the ice. One found that this land had been cleared of its ice for nearly 300,000 years, fairly recently, geologically speaking. We're talking about a million years ago. The other study looked at a sample from a different part of the country and found that it had been covered in ice continuously for the last 7.5 million years. Put those two studies together and you might think they're contradictory. How could Greenland have been covered with ice for the last 7.5 million years, but also not covered with ice for hundreds of thousands of years within that time frame? But if you think of these studies not in opposition to one another, but as complementary, you start to get a better picture of the Greenland landscape, one where parts of the land may have lost their ice cap while other areas may have kept it. This is important not only because it helps us understand our geological past, but because it informs us as we look to an unstable climate future. And the reason we're going to talk about it today is because one of the foremost laboratories studying Greenland and home to the researchers who did one of those studies is right here in Vermont at UVM. Joining me now to talk about Greenland's landscape are UVM geology professor Paul Bierman and postdoctoral researcher Lee Corbett. Paul and Lee, welcome to Vermont Edition. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Paul, you and Lee worked on the second study. This is the one that found a consistent presence of ice over the landscape for the last 7.5 million years. Is that actually what you were trying to determine, how long the ice cap had been there? Was that the focus of your study?
We were actually trying to determine a couple things. We actually worked on material that was collected by the Ocean Drilling Program in the early 1990s. So that's a core of marine sediment collected well offshore, hundreds of kilometers offshore in over a kilometer or 3,000 feet of water. And they collected tens of meters of sediment in a tube a couple inches wide. That's all been stored in Germany since then in a core repository. And they sent us hundreds of little baggies of sediment. And Lee can tell you more about what we did with those baggies of sediment. But our goal was to try
Is that what you make the researchers do? The postdoctoral researchers have to do the sediment
she's
stuff?
She's just really good at that kind of thing. And there's an awful lot of legwork behind what turned out to be about 50 measurements. In order to make the measurements that we need to do in the lab. But our goal was to try to figure out the history of the ice sheet over the last 7.5 million years using two very rare isotopes, one of beryllium and one of aluminum. And that's what we've done for 24 years in our laboratory at the university. But this was probably the most challenging measurement project we've faced yet, and maybe one with the biggest stakes in terms of understanding where the Greenland ice sheet that holds about 7 meters of sea level equivalent, what it had done in the past. And if you think 7 meters, 22, 23 feet, you can imagine what would be underwater if that melted.
Well, maybe you should tell us, because I think it is difficult to imagine, you know, 23 sure. feet in sea level, you know, unless you sort of have an understanding of what that means in terms of the landscape. It doesn't seem like much.
Absolutely. It doesn't seem like much if you're in coastal Maine on a rocky coast. But go think about Cape Cod if you've been there, or think about southern Connecticut and think about broad sandy beaches, or go further south to the Carolinas and look at the Outer Banks, or go to Florida and look at a topographic map and see how much of Florida would be completely underwater if we had 20 feet of sea level rise. And if you look and then go to a global picture and think about how many of the world's great cities are on deltas or near the coast, many, many of them will be underwater.
So when you're doing this research to find out how long the ice sheet has been there, you're not just thinking like a historian and thinking this is interesting to know. You are actually trying to look forward and see what this might mean for the future?
Well, geologists are a funny breed. We learn about the future by looking at the past. So Earth is an incredibly complex system, and we rely on nature to essentially run experiments. Unlike physicists or chemists, it's very hard to have a controlled geologic experiment. So we let nature do the work. And then we go back and we try to ferret out what happened. So in this case, we're trying to look at the long-term history of the Greenland ice sheet to understand if it disappeared in the past, for how long it might have disappeared, where it might have disappeared. And that will give us some clues as to what could happen in the future.
So Lee Corbett, Paul said that you were really good at this sample work. Can you talk a little bit about what you do to try to find out when and how long and where and, you know, what this ice sheet looked like when you're looking at isotopes? How does that actually tell you, you know, how long the ice sheet has been there?
So what we're doing is we're actually counting individual atoms. So we're operating at a very small scale. So we're counting atoms of beryllium-10 or aluminum-26. And those are both rare isotopes of those elements. And what they tell us is they actually tell us about times when that material was exposed to the sky. So we're working in material that's in ocean cores. So right now it's in the bottom of the ocean. But at one point, it was up on the Greenlandic landscape. And so when those isotopes build up in material on the Greenlandic landscape, that material then gets eroded and put into the ocean basins. So if we go and count these rare isotopes in this material, it's telling us about times when that sediment was on the landscape, and most importantly, when that landscape was not covered in a big thick ice sheet.
So if we were to look at a sample from a piece of land that has been consistently exposed in totality, hasn't been covered with ice or snow or anything that would cover it at all for the last 7.5 million years, you would have found a much, much greater concentration of these isotopes.
Right.
Because the sun has been beating down on that landscape.
Yes. So the isotopes are also radioactive. So we're looking at material that has been buried in the ocean basin for a few million years since it was deposited, and also probably buried under this ice sheet. So we're actually looking at very small concentrations in these isotopes. But you're right, it's the concentration of the isotope in the sediment that's telling us about the exposure history of this landscape.
And so that what you found from these samples was that likely for the last 7.5 million years, they had not been exposed to the sun.
Right. Or if they had been exposed, that it was quite short in duration. So we found that there weren't long periods of time where the Greenland ice sheet disappeared from the landscape.
And again, we're talking about short and long periods of time in geological time, not
speaking.
Human time. So like a couple thousand years would be a short amount of time.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So it may have been, I mean, you can't tell whether it could have been exposed for a couple thousand years, but we're not talking about something where the ice sheet cleared away and exposed this landscape for 100,000 or 200,000 years.
Yes, that's correct.
So what you found here is that this landscape from the samples that you took was covered in ice for, and 7.5 million years, is that because before that it was not covered, or before that you just don't know?
Well, the 7.5 million comes actually from the dating of the core that was done in the 90s. And the first time you see stones dropped out in the middle of the ocean is an interpretation of the first time that icebergs floated by, melted and dropped these stones the size of your fist out there. And some of them are actually have been brought up in the core. There's a hint that Greenland had small glaciers before then, even pushing back to a few tens of millions of years ago, but nothing big. The first package of these clasts, and you see them in Vermont farmers' fields as they till the fields. These clasts get brought up that were brought in from the glaciers here, probably brought from Canada, brought from farther north. The same thing happens in the ocean with the icebergs. And so that's the 7.5 million year age. And what we see is progressive glaciation after that. And I think we can conclude, like you were suggesting with Lee, that at most the ice sheet disappeared for thousands of years, maybe 10,000 years. But over that 7.5 million years, there's good evidence that the ice sheet was there most of the time. In particular, the last 1 million years, it looks like the ice sheet was there very much like it is today. And so that puts the ideas and the modeling and the suggestions from the pretty much the entire climate community that if we keep putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we keep warming the Earth, and the ice sheet disappears, that's going to be a geologically very unusual event. It's not something that happens with great frequency.
Except then we have this other study that comes out at the same time that yours does that suggests that from the samples that this research team was studying, it looks like the ice sheet had melted.
Yes, and actually the two studies, I would argue, are more powerful together than they are apart. Theirs was done on the western side of the high mountain range that's in East Greenland. That's confusing, but the east coast of Greenland has a big mountain range. Our samples, because of the way the ice sheet is organized reflect what was going on in East Greenland. Their sample location, which is one location under the ice sheet that was accessed in the early 1990s by a drill core that went down 3,000 meters, sort of almost 10,000 feet, and got 4 feet of bedrock at the bottom, brought it up. That bedrock has been sitting in a core repository since. Some early analyses made in the 90s were sort of ambiguous. Now we're so much better on the technology that they could be reanalyzed. So their data from this one spot suggests that the ice disappeared there, as you said, for a few hundred thousand years, 1 million to 1.5 million years ago. That's completely consistent with what we have. The question is, did the ice disappear after that? And it's possible, but it's not mandated by their data. And I don't think anybody would...
In other words, it cleared away for a couple hundred thousand years, yep. But for the last 1 million years, it might have been there consistently entire time.
It might well have been. Or it may have disappeared for a couple other short intervals. But what neither of the studies suggests is that the ice left repeatedly. And so when the climate models suggest that if we continue on our path now, we're going to remove most of the Greenland ice sheet, that's not really precedented in the times that humans have developed into their modern forms and our societies have developed and all of that, which is the conclusion that most of the people reading this came up with.
Because it may have disappeared, you know, before we were much of a factor, but not in the time frame
exactly.
That we're talking about human life.
1 million years ago, we're talking about humans mostly in Africa, perhaps into the Middle East, but not what we have today.
We're talking about this interesting research done in Greenland and in other places, but about Greenland that should help us understand our future, what might happen with climate change, and what's happened in the past, how that informs us as we think about the future. Listeners, if you have a question about Greenland, about what this science tells us, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note or a question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Lee Corbett, what did you think when you saw these two studies side by side?
I agree with Paul. I think the two studies are actually very complementary, and a lot of the media surrounding the studies originally when they came out suggested that they might have been at odds. But
because the narrative was one study says ice has been here for 7.5 million years, another study says the ice disappeared over Greenland.
That's correct. And science is all about asking questions and learning from different avenues. And like Paul said, the study that we worked on was looking at East Greenland in a very integrative fashion because we were looking at sediment that had washed into the ocean, whereas the other study was looking at bedrock from a specific area beneath the Greenland ice sheet. So they're actually a wonderful complement to one another. And I think it's a good argument that we need more of this kind of research in the future.
Is that because it's sort of like if you take one point, then you only have the data that tells you what happened on that specific part of the landscape. But if you have more points of data from more places, you have a better picture of what happened across the entire landscape. So you can't draw, you know, a broad conclusion from one small data point.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that the fact that these two studies were working at very different spatial scales is more powerful.
So does it suggest that the ice may have cleared in part of the landscape and stayed around in the higher elevation in East Greenland that you guys were studying?
Probably. And that's not surprising given the topography of the landscape under Greenland, that the eastern part of the island is where a lot of the high mountains are. So it's not unrealistic to think that ice caps may have resided up there, whereas the center of Greenland or western Greenland or southern Greenland ice sheet may have disappeared.
We got a note from Jeremy who says, I have heard that Greenland is essentially a bowl that is filled with ice. If the ice that covers most of Greenland melts, will there be a large lake left in its place, or will it eventually flow out into the ocean, leaving a large barren landscape? Also, given that Greenland was once at lower latitudes, is it expected that archaeological remains will be left behind as the ice sheet retreats? Paul Bierman?
That's a really interesting set of questions. I'll try to take them in pieces there. In terms of archaeological remains and the continental drift that moved Greenland, that time frame is too slow and too long for humans. But there's fascinating archaeology in Greenland of the Norse era. So we got lucky in that we've worked in southern Greenland. And I remember sitting and having lunch at about 35 degrees with snow flurries swirling around us, sitting on the bishop's seat in southern Greenland, which is nothing more today than basically a foundation that looks like you're in the Vermont woods. somewhere, and it's just a bunch of red stone all stacked up. But that was the bishop's seat, his house, the church, and all that. And we were sitting there with a couple sheep and our lunch. So fantastic archaeology of the last 1,500 years there in Greenland. In terms of Greenland filling up with a lake, the listener's absolutely right. The center of Greenland is a low point right now. And when the ice sheet melts, it will probably retreat rather rapidly into the center of Greenland there. It will become, at least for a short period of time, a marine margin where there'll be the glaciers will be calving off large icebergs. But then once the weight of that ice sheet is gone from Greenland, the landscape will respond by rising. It's been depressed right now because, Jane, as you said at the beginning of the program, 2 miles of ice sitting on there is quite the load. Imagine yourself with a beach ball and you're pushing down on the beach ball. It's going to squish out to the side. You take your hand off, it's going to rise back up. And that's what's going to happen to Greenland. So when we melt the Greenland ice sheet, that water goes into the global ocean. So ice that's been on land ends up in the ocean, and it causes the sea level to rise because we've increased the volume of water in there. So yes, the center of Greenland may have a temporary lake in it. It probably will be connected to the ocean, but then as it rises, that will drain, and that water will all end up rising sea level.
We're going to talk more about that as we come back, and we're also going to look at what might this mean for Greenland over time. We're talking here not about in the next decade, but what does a changing ice sheet in Greenland mean for the very small number of people who live there, for its future? It is geographically kind of in North America, but it belongs to Denmark, I believe. So what happens to Greenland in the future, and what does global climate change mean for us as it reflects what happens in Greenland? Our number 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note with a question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Paul Bierman is a professor of geology at UVM. Lee Corbett is a postdoctoral researcher at UVM and Boston College. They're with us today talking about the research they've been doing in Greenland to look at the history of the ice sheet there and what it might tell us about our global future. If you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or send us a note. You can write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Lee Corbett, very few people have ever been to Greenland, and I understand only about 50,000 people actually live there, but you've been several times now, five times or so?
Five times, yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to live and work there?
Yeah, certainly. It's not an easy place to work, we'll put it that way. I've done five separate field expeditions to Greenland to a variety of different areas, and it's an incredible landscape. I've really fallen in love with it. Wonderful people. I've had a pretty solid diversity of experiences there, sometimes living in small fishing villages, sometimes at American military bases, and then a few trips of getting dropped in the middle of nowhere by a helicopter for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. The weather is fairly challenging at times, especially in the far north extent of Greenland. Past three times I was there, I was at almost 80 degrees north latitude, so it's up there. The sun is out all the time, unless it's snowing, which I really love. The population density is very low. Like you said, it's about the population of Burlington, and Greenland's about half the size of the United States, so very low population density, and most people live in the capital city, which is called Nuuk in the southern part of Greenland. So it's an incredible landscape, a really wonderful little island, but not an easy place to work sometimes.
I understand there's also the threat of polar bears.
There is, yes. It depends on where in Greenland you are. But the work that I've done in far northern Greenland, we actually we keep a 24-hour watch and have enclosed camps in tripwires and alarms and carry a gun. And
so, and have you seen polar bears? I mean, that would be kind of one of those bucket list things, though, to see them.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because you don't really want to see one when you're in the remote field. I've been on the Air Force base when we've had a bear come on base and the whole base goes down into lockdown. I have never actually seen one when I've been in the remote field, and that is fine with me, and I hope that we keep it that way.
Now, Paul mentioned that there isn't a very long history of humans inhabiting Greenland. So who are the people who are, you know, were born here and living here? Because you mentioned the bases, and there are a lot of researchers, but what's the sort of, and I use native in more of its colloquial term, but what's the native population?
Most native Greenlanders are an Inuit people. And there's also quite a few Danes who live there because Greenland is a territory of Denmark. So it's really a mix between those two populations. And then the United States has a pretty significant military population there as well, leftover Cold War era bases.
So you fell in love with it, but you're not planning to move there.
I think I'll stay in Vermont.
Paul, why do you and Lee go to Greenland if the samples that you're working on are samples that were collected a while ago and that you do, you know, some of this research in the lab here in Vermont and in other places around the world? Why keep going back?
Well, the research we've been doing has been funded by the National Science Foundation. And the fundamental questions we've been asking are, first, what's the history of the ice sheet? But then also, how does it work? How does it erode sediment? How do glaciers behave? And in order to do that, we needed to do field work outside of getting the core sent to us from Bremen, Germany. So Lee and I first went up there in 2008, and we're sampling along with another UVM master student, another UVM faculty, and colleagues from, at that point, from Lawrence Livermore National Lab. We were sampling the margins of the ice sheet, looking at the history of surfaces where the ice had been and was now gone. And we went back again in 2011 and 2012 to do more of that sampling, actually collecting sand and cobbles from underneath the ice where streams were dispatching or from frozen pieces of ice. That's more work that we're doing in the lab right now. And in really trying to get a full picture of how the ice sheet works, one of the issues with just going to a marine core is you've just got the core. You don't, as a geologist, you want to see how the system works. You want to use your eyes. You want to sample other pieces of that entire ice sheet system. So I think it's been actually really important that a group of us over time has been repeatedly to see how things work and to collect these other samples because it sets our work in context that we've done on the course.
We have some listeners with questions. Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
Hello. Yeah, I just had this question. Recently, a very large canyon was discovered under the ice, supposedly larger than the Grand Canyon. And also, I wonder if there is any maritime archaic sites on the island.
Peter, thanks for the call. Lee or Paul, which one of you wants to tackle that?
The canyon, I know, was found by doing sub-ice surveys because it's, of course, still buried under ice, right? And one of the questions is when and how that canyon was cut. And does it reflect what Greenland looked like prior to 7.5 million years ago when there maybe was no ice sheet on there? And is it a residual? And we don't know that. And it's a question that might be answered by drilling programs that have been proposed in the future to get back down to the bottom of the ice sheet. The problem is it takes a lot of time, and that means a lot of money to get through 3,000 meters of ice and get to the rock at the bottom. Can you explain more what you mean by the maritime sites?
Peter?
The maritime archaic culture had specific burial practices. They were in the Canadian maritime until about 7,000 years ago, or that's about the age of the sites, but they were called the Red Paint People originally. They bury their people with red ochre covering all the funerary goods and the bodies. And they also buried boats similar to the Norse.
Peter, wow, that's very interesting. And you, I think, seem to be more knowledgeable than we are here in the studio on that. No archaeologists here, but it does sound like there is an opportunity for archaeologists as this work continues to look at some of the things that you were talking about and what Paul Biermann was mentioning before with some of the Norse areas that were populated. Let's hear from Willem, who's calling in from Heinsberg. Hi, Willem.
Hi, good morning. Nice to hear of all of this information, Paul. I had a question about the fossil record. Might there not have been a fossil record that would show cold-adapted organisms and then maybe some warm-adapted organisms that would show ice sheets and non-ice sheets in these core samples?
Thanks for the question, Willem.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. The cores have certainly been looked at for what are called forams or foraminifera, which are these very small sort of microscopic planktonic organisms that can be used to indicate warm and cold periods. But on Greenland themselves are this series of really enigmatic deposits that Lee and I have actually been thinking about for 3 or 4 years now in trying to date those deposits. There are places where the ice missed, where the ice ran over them and didn't remove them. And so on parts of Greenland and parts of the Canadian Northern Archipelago are these deposits that have warm species in terms of plants, in terms of animals, and they're very poorly dated right now. And so one of the things we've been trying really hard to do is get some National Science Foundation funding to go up there. They're in extremely remote locations. It's challenging logistics, and bring some of those samples back to date them. I think the work that came out in Nature between two of our groups will hopefully make it easier to get support to do that, because these deposits, there are about half a dozen of them scattered in the Arctic, suggest that there was a time in the past when the Arctic was quite warm. But the dates range from 2 million years to 10 million years, and there's really very little constraint on how old they are. And I think at this point, there'll be much better logic for saying we really need to know when these warm deposits were deposited there.
Wow, boy, it sounds like there's an area for a lot more researchers, and you know, this idea of a fight between two groups of researchers about whether Greenland was barren of ice or not, even though that's not the actual truth, is sort of creating this buzz that might make for more funding or more interest in the country.
Yeah, and you're welcome to come with us, you know.
All right, okay. Yeah, don't tempt me.
You have to fly small planes and helicopters and fight polar bears. But no, I think you're absolutely right. And I should say that we work very closely with the other group that published this paper. We're all basically collaborators and share data and share ideas. But I think you're right. It's going to excite the community to say, these are opportunities.
Another question here from Alan in North Pomfret. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for putting on this really interesting program. Here's my question. I'm wondering what the effect might be of, assuming there's considerable warming, what the effect might be of a massive amount of fresh water going into the ocean and affecting the Gulf Stream. And I'm wondering how... If that would have some effects on our climate here in New England and also on Western Europe.
Alan, thanks very much for the question. Lee?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that climate scientists have thought about a lot and will probably continue to think about a lot. The idea here is that the ocean currents are what transports all of the heat on the planet, and a key part in the ocean current is where in the Arctic, that warm water coming up from the equatorial latitudes takes a dive and goes deep into the ocean and then recycles back down to the equator. And it's really sort of a conveyor belt that serves to bring heat up to the higher latitudes. That's why places like London are so warm, given that they're at higher latitude. And so the thought process, and this has probably happened numerous times throughout history, is that if you put a bunch of fresh water into the North Atlantic Ocean, you essentially stick a fork in that conveyor belt. It would be like if you went to the grocery store and were trying to foil the conveyor belt there, and you stop the ocean from being able to turn over and circulate heat. And it's a process that has happened numerous times and has probably led to several of the cold periods that we've experienced, including one that was only a couple hundred years ago called the Little Ice Age. And so it's certainly an interesting question as we move forward that you have the Greenland ice sheet sitting there, which is obviously a very large source of fresh water. And if that fresh water is released quickly by melting, I think that that could be a process that we might be looking at in the future. And it would certainly have impacts for areas like Vermont and New England.
Paul?
I should say that the people who've looked at this think that it is a high impact but low probability event in the sort of human timescales. So there's a chance it will happen. It's probably on a timescale longer than you and I being on here. It may take hundreds of years if it does happen. So looking at the Hollywood version of that is well, many of us have seen that movie, is not realistic. It's not going to happen in a period of days. And again, we don't know, but it's one of those things that is certainly out there. It has happened on long time scales with big deglaciations. And it would most likely affect the areas around the North Atlantic more than any place else. So New England, England, that part of Europe, if it did happen.
Although, as you pointed out, this raising of the global sea level would affect all kinds of coastal populations for, you know, all over the world.
Yeah, I think the real worry we face with climate change from a global point of view is sea level rise.
Lee Corbett, what about the potential for some changes in Greenland? You were talking about the people who live there and the native population, and if Greenland loses its ice, if it becomes a warmer place, there is the potential for some changes to that population.
Yes, that's absolutely true, especially in a place like Greenland, which is largely a subsistence economy. It's a primarily fishing-based economy and primarily people who live pretty close to the landscape. And so a lot of the work that they do there is closely tied to seasonal cycles and abilities to, you know, get out on the ice and fish through the ice or transport using dog sleds on the ice. So, yeah, so it's certainly an area that will be impacted in the future by climate change and by things like lack of sea ice, which is already something that we're seeing now.
Those sound like pretty negative things, but there are some positive potentials for a longer growing season, right? And possibly some more mining that they might be able to do. And even geopolitically, it could mean a chance to split from Denmark, for example.
Yeah, that's correct. Greenland right now is essentially a colony of Denmark. If they want to achieve independence, Greenland will need to figure out how to make up that economic, the subsidy on their own. And so mining is a likely future direction that Greenland will choose to go.
Boy, there is a lot still to be discovered and to be understood and a lot to find out. I mean, we're talking thousands of years here, not tens of years. So we may not be around to see all of it, but it's really fascinating research. Paul Bierman is a professor of geology at UVM. Lee Corbett is a postdoctoral researcher at UVM and Boston College. Thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us here.
Coming up, two young lawmakers trying to make a name for themselves in Montpelier. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's a lot of experience in the State House, but each session there are neophytes getting their first taste of statewide politics. In some cases, it's the first time they're participating in any kind of major political race of their own. That describes two new young lawmakers just starting out this year. Ben Jickling is 22 years old. Jay Hooper is 23. They're both from Brookfield, and both are now in their first terms representing the two-seat Orange-Washington-Addison district in the Vermont House. That district encompasses Brookfield, Randolph, Braintree, Granville, and Roxbury. Representatives Jickling and Hooper are with us now. Welcome to Vermont Edition, and congratulations on your wins.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jane.
Ben Jickling, I'll ask you first, and then Jay, same question, but what motivated you to run for the House? Why did you want to take on this big job?
Right. So I grew up in Vermont, went to public school in Randolph. It's a place I love, a place I want to live for a long time. So I've been interested in Vermont politics for a couple years. I thought, why not get involved, bring a fresh perspective, something a little bit different to the conversation here in Montpelier.
Ben, people often say, though, you should start small. And, that's the advice that politicians are often given. Start with your local school board or start with, a town position and then move your way up to statewide politics. But you seem to have skipped all that.
Right. I thought, I think I can bring something different to the legislature, which motivated me. And I think, voters were obviously receptive of that and willing to give somebody a bit different a chance in the legislature.
Jay, what about for you? What motivated you?
Jane, the way I put it to the voters throughout the campaign was that I see government as something that needs to be part of the solution to the greatest issues of today and tomorrow. Government's not going away. So we need people to trust government. And for the past several years, I've seen people think of government as corruption. And I think Bernie Sanders was tremendously successful in galvanizing support amongst people our age. And I said, I can continue that narrative. So I'm going to pursue it.
Jay, when you got out on the campaign trail and talked to people in your district and said, you know, I want your vote, did you face any age bias? Did you see people saying or looking at you funny for being so young?
Oh, certainly. You know, actually, the question would often be when I got to someone's door, aren't you a little young for this? And I would look up to them and smile and say, well, sure, maybe I'm young, but I don't think too young, and we'll find out. So how about a vote?
And what did they say to you then?
You know, sometimes they'd be, well, give me an idea where you stand on the issues. And then, you know, I'd say, well, of course, I'm a liberal Democrat for the most part. So I'm loosely based off of the Democratic platform. But, you know, for me, it's about the principles of representation. So let's ask you, what are your issues? What do you care about?
And Ben, for you, you're an independent. How did you tell people what you would represent and why you should represent them?
Right. It's a little bit more challenging as an independent just because, you know, I get to develop my own platform. And it takes some work to, you know, communicate that to the voters, you know, that are voting for me in November. But, you know, I posed it as a question. I said, yes, there are benefits to experience. But, you know, a breadth of voices in Montpelier is important. People with all sorts of life experiences, you know, and all sorts of backgrounds can only help to, you know, make a more diverse and vibrant discussion in the legislature. And I think people respected that and saw the need to make a change.
Ben, will you be caucusing with one of the parties?
No, I won't. You know, Vermont has open caucuses, so I can, you know, pop in and out of both. Which I'm looking forward to doing.
I'm going to encourage him to go listen in on the Republicans and report back.
Because, Jay, you're a Democrat, so you'll already be there. So.
Yeah, and of course, I'm going to keep him up to date on that stuff. So.
Well, do you guys think of yourselves as a team now? I mean, you are the two-member district, and you both are new. So do you – but you also were running against one another, and you're not in the same party since Ben is an independent and Jay, you're a Democrat. So
right.
Do you two plan to sort of be a team, or is there a sense that it's each man and woman for his or her own?
You know, obviously we are individual legislators, and I think that's important. But, you know, I played, you know, Little League baseball with Jay. So, you know.
Yeah, we actually won two championships together in Little League.
So we're friends. You know, we're going to work together for the best of our district. You know, I don't think we're necessarily a team, but we've already been working, you know, together before and look forward to doing so.
I think that we are competitive with one another. We were rivals during the campaign for sure. You know, when you're talking about one of us, you're implicitly talking about the other one. In terms of, you know, the two young guys, and we validated each other's candidacies, which I think was beneficial to the both of us. But I do see us cooperating already. You know, I told him I'm going to be looking out for you, and I hope you'll give me a reason to look out. I hope you do the same for me. So.
Well, Jay, you said you two validated one another's candidacies, but that wasn't a guarantee. I mean, two very young new lawmakers who don't have a lot of state house experience could, in fact, be even more pitted against one another, because you might think that even if voters had the opportunity and the desire to have one young lawmaker, the other
right.
vote might go to a more seasoned lawmaker. And Jay, I understand Ben started first. So
he did.
How did
you get
motivated?
So this guy was light years ahead of me on the campaign trail the whole way through. And that actually that displayed on the voting numbers on the day after the election. Yeah, I think it was important for us to both understand that the consensus in the district was that Patsy French, the incumbent who was running for re-election, largely as my teammate, she would be in first place. She was going to win, and then it would be between the two of us. So that was difficult for me to swallow sometimes, but. It kept me honest. It kept me working hard. And we certainly had a visible presence around the district. We were covering ground quickly.
And then in the end, of course, it wasn't Patsy French who won. It was Jicklian Hooper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think the thing to keep clear is that Patsy is still probably more popular than the both of us. Everybody loved her. I think were ready and willing to give us both a shot. And I guess enough people decided that, well, geez, probably only one of them will win, so I might as well throw the other vote to the other one.
Well, I think that, you know, the voting results really, you know, validated the work we put in and the campaigns we ran, and I think voters appreciated that.
Yep.
And supported that. And I think that, you know, came true on Election Day.
Yeah, I hear one of you taking a steep intake of breath. Jay, you wanted to chime in there?
I mean, I just figured I'd give this a chance to say to give a shout out to Patsy French and to just recognize my appreciation for all the help that she, you know, gave to my campaign, and that I continue to look to work with her. So,
Ben, for you, the thing you're most looking forward to in this first term as a legislator?
A whole lot of things. You know, I really enjoy policy, so that's this is the place to be if you enjoy that. So I'm looking forward to, you know, talking about a whole host of issues, whether it's, you know, attracting and retaining young families in Vermont, bringing some reliable high-speed internet, making sure we have affordable childcare, all those type of things is stuff I'm looking forward to working on.
And Jay, 10 seconds for you to give us your top priorities for the session.
Oh, sure. So I'm passionate about climate issues. My older brother Miles has a son who's just turned just over a year old. So I really think that climate change is going to be important to his future and mine. So,
all right. Well, I appreciate both of you taking the time to be here again. Congratulations on your wins. Ben Jickling and Jay Hooper are new representatives, both from Brookfield, representing the 2-seat Orange Washington Addison District in the Vermont House. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
And finally, today we hear from the latest local music act featured on VPR's Live from the Fort. Spend enough time in the Vermont music scene and you start to notice a handful of talented musicians playing in several different bands. Four such musicians have combined forces in the new band, the Welterweights, and they played their first gig under that name right here in VPR's Studio One. The Welterweights are Kelly Raven, also known as the singer-guitarist for Waylon Speed, Lowell Thompson, who's had a strong solo career, drummer Willoughby Morse, who plays with Medela, and bassist Aaron Cassells Brown. Our own Music Insider tells us if there's a good band playing somewhere in Vermont, Aaron's in it. Here they are all together in their debut as the Welterweights with the song Headline Show.
We're gonna be a firework fanatic.
That's the Welterweights playing the song Headline Show for VPR's Live from the Fort music video series. Catch the entire four-song set online at vpr.net. That's it for today. Tomorrow, if you feel like you and your doctor speak different languages, how do you get on the same page about your health? We'll talk about communication in the world of medicine and how both doctors and patients can get better at it. Send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.